Hi, so I have homework to do, and that homework is to get started reading on Silas Marner by George Eliot. I was supposed to get up to chapter 10 tonight, but if I masturbated all the way through that, I would be like my clit would be like gone by the end of the night. I'm just gonna start at the beginning and hysterical literature my way as far into it as I can get before I start getting paranoid that I'm gonna get walked in on. So let's go, shall we? I'm going to turn my vibrator on now. Yep, hello, vibrator. Okay, so Silas Marner by George Eliot, Chapter 1. In the days when the spinning wheels hummed busily in the farmhouses, and even the great ladies, clothed in silk and thread lace, had their toy spinning wheels of polished oak, there might be seen in districts far away among the lanes, or deep in the bosom of the hills, certain pallid, undersized men who, by the side of the brawny country folk, looked like the remnants of a disinherited race. By the way, I'm not too great at reading out loud. So forgive me. I'm gonna start losing it real quick once I start getting closer. Haha. Oh, okay, there we go. Okay. The shepherd's dog barked fiercely when one of these alien-looking men appeared on the upland, whatever, dark against the early winter sunset. For what dog likes a figure bent under a heavy bag? And these pale men rarely stirred abroad without that mysterious burden. The shepherd himself, though he had good reason to believe that the bag held nothing but flax and thread, or else the long rolls of strong linen spun from that thread, was not quite sure that this trade of weaving, indispensable though it was, could be carried on entirely without the help of the evil one. In that far-off time, superstition clung easily round every person or thing that was at all unwonted, or even intermittent and occasional, merely like the visits of the peddler or the knife grinder. Ooh. I just turned my vibrator on so that hopefully this will start to get interesting soon. No one knew where wandering men had their homes or their origin. And how was a man to be explained unless you at least knew somebody who knew his father and mother? To the peasants of old times, the world outside their own direct experience was a region of vagueness and mystery. To their untraveled thought, a state of wandering was a conception as dim as the winter life of the swallows that came back with the spring, and even a settler, if he came from distant parts, hardly ever ceased to be viewed with a remnant of distrust, which would have prevented any surprise if a long course of inoffensive conduct on his part had ended in the commission of a crime, especially if he had any reputations for knowledge or showed any skill in handicraft. All cleverness, whether in the rapid use of that difficult instrument, the tongue. Ooh. Rapid in use of that difficult instrument, the tongue, eh? Or in some other art unfamiliar to villagers, was in itself suspicious. Honest folks, born and bred in a visible manner, were mostly not overwise or clever, at least not beyond such a manner as knowing the signs of the weather, and the process by which rapidity and dexterity of any kind were acquired, and what was so wholly hidden that they partook of the nature of conjuring. In this way it came to pass that those scattered linen weavers, emigrants from the town into the country, were to the last regarded as aliens by their rustic neighbors, and usually contracted the eccentric habits which belonged to a state of loneliness. In the early years of this century, such a linen weaver named Silas Marner worked at his vocation in a stone cottage that stood among the nutty hedgerows near the village of Ravelo, not far from the edge of a deserted stone pit. The questionable sound of Silas's loom, so unlike the natural cheerful trotting of the winnowing machine, or the simpler rhythm of the flail, had a half-fearful fascination for the Ravelin boys, who would often leave off their nutting or bird's nesting to peep in at the window of the stone cottage, counterbalancing a certain awe at the mysterious action of the loom by a pleasant sense by a present fuck shit, I got a text message and lost my place. Hang on. Fuck. Can you hear my vibrator? I am responding to the text message and getting back to my homework now. Okay. To my homework or my vibrator? Fuck. Oh, fuck. Where was I? By a pleasant sense of scornful superiority, drawn from the mockery of its alternating noises, along with the bent treadmill attitude of the weaver. But sometimes it happened that Marner, pausing to adjust an irregularity in his thread, became aware of the small scoundrels, and through cherry, I don't know, of his time. He liked their intrusion so ill that he would descend from his loom and, opening the door, would fix on them a gaze that was always enough to make them take to their legs in terror. Sorry, I have to... This recording's been a little bit boring, hasn't it? So I'm trying to make it a little more exciting for you, but playing with myself a little bit. My vibrator. Okay, fuck. For how is it possible to believe that those loud, large brown, protuberant eyes in Silas Marner's pale face really saw nothing, very distinctly that was not close to them, and not rather that their dreadful stare could dart cramp or rickets or a wry mouth at any boy who happened to be in the rear. They had perhaps heard their father's and mother's hint that Silas Marner could cure folks' rheumatism if he had a mind, and add still more darkly that if you could only speak the devil fair enough, he might save you the cost of the doctor. Look. Okay. Ugh, all over. Sorry about the bed noise there. Okay. Such strange lingering echoes of the old demon worship might perhaps even now be caught by the diligent listener among the gray-haired peasantry. For the rude mind with difficulty associates the ideas of power and benignity. Beninity? Ah, fuck. A shadowy conception of power that by as much persuasion can be induced to refrain from inflicting harm is the shape most easily taken by the sense of the invisible in the minds of men who have always been pressed close by primitive wants. Primitive wants. And to whom a life of hard toil has never been illuminated by any enthusiastic religious faith. To them, pain and mishap present a far wider range of possibilities than gladness and enjoyment, Their imagination is almost barren of the images that feed desire and hope, but is all overgrown by the recollections that are a perpetual pasture to fear. Is there anything you fancy that you would like to eat? I once said to an old laboring man who was in his last illness, and he refused all the food his wife had offered him. No, he answered, I've never been used to nothing but common victual, and I can't eat that. Experience had bred no fancies in him that he could raise the phantasm of appetite. And Ravelo was a village where many of the old echoes lingered, undrowned by new voices. Not that it was one of those barren parishes lying on the outskirts of civilization, inhabited by meager sheep and thinly scattered shepherds. On the contrary, it lay in the rich central plain of what we are pleased to call Merry England, and held farms which, speaking from a spiritual point of view, paid highly desirable tithes. But it was nestled in a snug, well-wooded hollow, quite an hour's journey on horseback from any turnpike, where it was never reached by vibrations of the coach horn or of public opinion. It was an important-looking village, with a fine old church and large churchyard in the heart of it, and two or three large brick and stone homesteads, with well-walled orchards and ornamental weathercocks. Cocks. Cocks. Standing close upon the road, and lifting more imposing fronts than the rectory, which peeped from among the trees on the other side of the churchyard, a village which showed at once the summits of its social life and told the practiced eye that there was no great park and manor house in the vicinity, but there were several several chiefs in Ravelo who could farm badly at quite at their ease, drawing enough money from their bad farming in those war times to live in a rollicking fashion and keep a jolly Christmas, Whitsun, and Easter tide. Oh, fuck. I need to adjust my vibrator if I'm ever going to come in this audio. Fuck. Fuck. I'm a big full shit. Okay. It was 15 years since Silas Marner had first come to Ravelo. He was then a simply pallid young man with prominent, short-sighted brown eyes. His appearance could have had nothing strange for people of average culture and experience, but for the villagers near whom he had come to settle, it had mysterious peculiarities which corresponded with the exceptional nature of his occupation. And this advent from an unknown region called Northard. Fuck. So had his way of life. He invited no comer to comer. To step across his door sill, and he never strolled into the village to drink a pint at the Rainbow or to gossip at the wheelwrights. Gossip at the wheelwrights. He sought no man or woman He sought no man or woman save for the purposes of his calling in order to supply himself with the necessaries. And it was soon clear to the Ravelo lasses that he would never urge one of them to accept him against her will, quite as if he had heard them declare that they would never marry a dead man come to life again. This view of Marner's personality was not without another ground than his pale face and unexampled eyes. For Jem Rodney, the mole catcher, averred that one evening as he was returning homeward, he saw Silas Marner leaning against a stile with a heavy bag on his back instead of resting the bag on the stile as a man in his senses would have done, and that on coming up to him he saw Marner's eyes were set like a dead man's, and spoke to him and shook him, and his limbs were stiff, and his hands clutched the bag as if they'd been made of iron. But just as he had made up his mind that the weaver was dead, he came all right again, like, as you might say, in the winking of an eye, and said good night and walked off. All this Jem swore he had seen, more by token that it was the very day that he had been mole-catching on Squire Cass's land down by the old saw pit. Some said Marner must have been in a fit, a word which seemed to explain things otherwise incredible. Oh, fuck. Oh, fuck, I'm gonna come. The argumentative Mr. Macy, clerk of the parish, shook his head and asked him, anybody was ever known to go off in a fit and not fall down. If it was a stroke, wasn't it? And it was the nature of a stroke to partly take away the use of a man's limbs and throw him onto the parish if he got no children to look to. No, no, it was no stroke that would let a man stand on his legs like a horse between the shafts and then walk off as soon as you could say, gee. But there might be such a thing as a man's soul being loose from his body and going out and in like a bird out of its nest and back. And that was how folks got other overwise, for they went to school in this shellless state. To those who could teach them more than their neighbors could learn with their five senses and the parson. And where did Master Marner get his knowledge of herbs from? And charms, too, if he liked to give them away. Hey, Jem Rodney's story was no more than what might have been expected anybody who had seen how Marner had cured. Fuck. Expected by anybody who had seen how Marner had cured Sally Oates and made her sleep like a baby when her heart had been beating enough to burst her body for 2 months and more while she had been under the doctor's care. He might cure more folks if he would, but he was worth speaking fair if it was only to keep him from doing you mischief. It was partly... Fuck, how long is this fucking chapter? Been going on for 20 minutes. I'm starting to get paranoid that I'm gonna get walked in on. So I'm just gonna stop here and take myself off. Fuck. Thanks for sticking with me. Bye.